welcome to episode 59 of the DFA podcast. I'm your host, Brian Grossnick, and joining me, as always, is my co-host, RJ Anderson. RJ, we are just starting off the month of May. We've got 1 month of awesome baseball behind us, kind of weird baseball in some ways. Are you enjoying yourself so far this early part of the season?
Yeah, of course. And you're right, it has been a little weird. We have some teams out in front that we didn't really expect, and it'll be interesting to see if they can hold on to the leads they've worked to develop, or if things will revert to what we expected entering the year over the coming months.
Yeah, that is a really smooth transition into our lead topic for today. While a lot of things have happened over the last couple of weeks between the last DFA podcast and this episode, our big move that we're going to talk about first has to do with one of those teams that's really kind of surprised, I think, in taking the lead in their division. And recently they have added to their roster, trying to improve. That team I'm talking about is the Atlanta Braves, who, as of today, as of this recording, have a half-game lead in the National League East over the New York Mets. It's weird to think that the Washington Nationals are in fourth place in the division, which is kind of bizarre and under 500. But the big move relating to them is actually a couple of moves. They've called up the world's greatest prospect in Ronald Acuna. And then also recently in the last couple of days, they brought up Mike Soroka, who's probably their number one pitching prospect, to make his major league debut and naturally beat the Mets. So tell me about what you found from these two guys and the Braves this start to the season, and what you've seen so far from Acuna and Soroka.
Well, it's kind of funny because they have like the three youngest players in baseball now.
Right.
Ozzie Albies was the youngest player in baseball, and then you bring up Acuna, who's even younger, and Soroka. I don't know which of those two is younger. Looks like Acuna was born in December of 1997. And Soroka in August 1997. So Acuna is almost certainly the youngest player in baseball at this point. And yeah, I mean, it goes to show kind of why Alex Anthopoulos lucked into this job, because not only did they have a new ballpark, and not only did they have some interesting pieces in place, and Freeman and Swanson, and I guess if you want to throw Inciarte and maybe even Tehran into the mix, but now you get to dig into this farm system. And you know, in addition to these guys, Sean Newcomb has been surprisingly good. And, you know, they have some other pieces who have been playing seemingly above their heads. But, you know, we'll see if Ryan Flaherty keeps it up as one of the best hitters on a competitive team or not. I'm going to guess not. But,
it's
really interesting. And it's fun to watch these youngsters come up. I mean, Acuna, he was in the majors for, what, a day before he hit that huge home run off Homer Bailey?
That was something else. That was exactly the type of game I feel like that we were hoping for when we've seen Acuna and all the hype he's had in the minor leagues. He's off to a really great start to his major league career. He's in seven games. He's got like a 345, 406, 621 slash line. He's hitting the cover off the ball. He's still, he's actually walking at a decent rate, and granted it's just seven games, but he's not being crazy aggressive. So that's always been nice. And, Soroka really handled himself very well. I mean, granted it's the Mets lineup, and the Mets lineup hasn't exactly been a world beater recently, but they are the number two team in the division, and they've really earned their spot, at the top of the National League East. You also mentioned Albies, and Albies is not one of these call-ups that we're talking about, but he's been phenomenal to start the season, showing way more power than I ever expected to see from him, and I think more power than anybody ever imagined to see from him. And with that, you know, he's already hit 9 home runs this season, which is completely unbelievable. I can't imagine he's going to continue to hit for this kind of power, but if I never imagined he'd hit 9 home runs in the first month of the season either.
Yeah, and I would even throw Johan Camargo in there as another infield prospect who was not known for his ability to hit for power. Then he comes to the majors, and in just under 300 plate appearances, he has a career 481 slugging. That's a 181 ISO. We didn't expect this from either of these guys, and I actually have been asking around, like, when did Albies develop his power?
Right.
And it seems like maybe he made a little bit of an adjustment with his swing to invoke his lower half a little more. But, you know, that's kind of a post hoc explanation. I don't quite know for certain. I have to go back and look a little closer. But if he's hitting for power, all of a sudden that changes his profile completely for me, because I'll admit that I thought there was a chance he was going to be Jose Peraza 2.0, a very quick runner who, you know, has bat-to-ball skills, but who also doesn't really like to walk and won't punish mistakes. So, you know, pitchers basically can go up there and test him and see if he's Brett Gardner or Sam Fold, you know, on that spectrum. And, you know, to his credit, if he's hitting for power, I mean, even if he's hitting for a little less power than he's hit for so far, that changes his profile completely. And all of a sudden you're talking about a guy who, yeah, he was worth the hype, and he's probably going to make a couple all-star games during his career. So that's a huge development for them. And I mentioned Newcomb as well. You know, if he's legitimately able to limit his walks, that's another huge development for them, because you put him together with Soraka and with, you know, Kyle Wright, who should fly through the minors as well. And all of a sudden, you have a pretty good-looking rotation. And we aren't even, you know, including Tehran or Fulte in this conversation. So,
well,
yeah, the Braves are on the rise. And I don't, you know, to be clear, I don't think the Braves are going to win this division. I don't think they're going to win a wild card spot. But this team certainly looks like it may finish the season in far better, in a far better condition than we expected them to, again, just a month ago.
Yeah, there's a couple of things I want to touch on there. You talk about the comps for Ozzie Albies. I thought he was going to be better than Jose Peraza just because his bat-to-ball was so good and his other secondary skills were a little more refined than Peraza. But the Jose he resembles more now is Jose Altuve, and that's quite the difference. I mean, obviously he's not going to hit for this much power, because if he hits for this much power, he's going to end the season with 45 home runs. And that's... I mean, I believe that his power has increased. I do not believe that he is, you know, now a tiny Giancarlo Stanton. So I think that's kind of out of the realm of possibility. But you talked about Camargo. I really thought going into this offseason that the Braves needed to go out and get a third baseman, like a Mike Moustakas or a Todd Frazier, somebody like that. And the way that Camargo has continued to play, the way that Swanson has recovered and Albies has taken that next step, it kind of looks like, in hindsight, that I might have been wrong there, that they have enough internal infield depth to really be able to hold their own. And I'm a little bit surprised by it, but in a pleasant way.
Yeah, I certainly was with you. I thought they were an ideal landing spot for Moustakas, Todd Frazier, maybe even trading for someone. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, no, it's worked out perfectly fine for them. Even, you know, way better than expectations on my end, and probably way better than expectations on their end, too. Because
sure.
I refuse to believe that they thought Ryan Flaherty was going to hit this well. I mean, come on. It's yeah. Ryan Flaherty.
Yeah, exactly. And he's the type of player that the Braves have brought in for years where they have a utility guy who doesn't have a great offensive profile. They brought in guys like Emilio Bonifacio and those type of players in the past. And Flaherty just seemed to fit that mold of a guy who can kind of do anything and play everywhere. And, yeah, he's starting to tail off a little bit, and I imagine that tail off will continue for ages, and Camargo will get the brunt of the playing time at third base. But it's been a pretty cool season for them so far. You also mentioned Tehran and Foltynewicz, and it's interesting because Foltynewicz and Newcomb now look like the mirror images of each other. You got one from the right and one from the left, where you have guys who strike out a bunch of guys who have control issues, but can give you a really impressive performance every once in a while. And both of them have looked really sharp to start the season. The downside is that Julio Tehran looks broken, right? I mean, it seems like something is very, very wrong with him at this point. His velocity has never been, you know, exceptional, but it looks really bad to start the season. And so it's kind of a good thing, I think, that the Braves are having guys like Soroka and Newcomb take another step forward, hopefully, where the guy who's kind of been the crux of this rotation for so long, it may not be long for this rotation much longer. I don't know if it's an injury issue or just overall performance.
Yeah, I would assume there's an injury there, but his command has been horrible. And hopefully it's, you know, everything straightened out, because we all kind of think of him as like the old man of his staff.
Right. Ancient Julio Tehran.
Right. And he's in his age 27 season. It feels like he's been there for 10 years and he hasn't. So I do hope he gets it straightened out. But yeah, and Newcomb is just so fascinating to me, because when you watch his delivery, it looks so easy, and, you know, with John Lester comparisons make sense. But then when you try to figure out, well, why does this guy always walk like 4+ batters per nine? And you slow it down, his arm kind of stalls. And you say, ah, you know, it's deceptively easy, wherein, you know, it really does look easy, but it's not as efficient as maybe guys who throw more strikes have their arm strokes be. So I have not watched him in slow motion or anything, but I'd be curious to see if they tinkered with that. Maybe that's helped lead to some improvement, though I say that, and he's still walking 4/9. It's just a matter of, you know, maybe not having those games where he walks, you know, 6 or 7 or whatnot. And, you know, he's missing bats and all. And you're right, him and Fulte are basically the same guy on different sides of the coin. And I'm really curious to see how aggressive they get with Kyle Wright, because I know you mentioned Soraka was probably their top pitching prospect. I really, really like Kyle Wright, and I thought that he should have went earlier in the draft than he did. You know, he went 4, so I don't know. I guess I would have probably picked him over Brendan McKay, honestly. And I think there's a chance that, well, I don't know if he'll be up in this year, but I think there's a chance if they're competitive until, you know, the last embers of the season, they might bring him up, and it might not be in a starting role or anything, but I don't know. I'm just curious to see how they do that, because they jumped him right to double A this year. And I know the results haven't necessarily been there, but we're also talking about, you know, a month of the season. So I don't know. It's just one of those things where the Braves have even more young talent on the way, and we'll see when they decide to hit the gas for a little bit. But it's going to make their offseason very interesting, because that's a team that should have spending money. It's a team that obviously has young talent, a new ballpark to sell players on, and maybe they get involved at the top end of the pool and they try to land Harper or Machado or someone of that ilk. Because if they do, this team suddenly becomes very interesting heading forward.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And I find it really interesting, because I've been really critical of the Braves' rebuilding strategy of seeming to focus more on pitching prospects. Now, they have done a lot to add some positional players as well, some of it legal, some of it not. And so Acuna and Albies and Swanson are making up a pretty decent young core on the position side, but they really went all in on pitchers. And now that Newcomb is starting to come around, and now that Foltynewicz is starting to come around, you have a couple of guys, but this is a team that traded away a lot of talent in order to return pitching talent. And Newcomb and Foltynewicz are pitching talent that was returned in trades, but it looks like, if long-term the Braves are going to have good young pitching, most of it's going to be coming from their draft side, which you know, still makes me a little uncomfortable with the way that they developed the team in terms of their acquisitions when they decided to do their sell-offs. But it'll definitely paper over some of their unfortunate trades in the past if they get to be a good team, even if it's on the strength of their draft.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. You know who we've just stopped talking about at all with regards to this team, who, you know, a year ago we were talking about nonstop? Kevin Maton, Maiton.
Right, yeah.
He's with the Angels now, obviously. But, yeah, I mean, he was supposed to be, like, the next big deal, and now Acuna has safely passed him. And it's kind of funny to think about what we thought about these two guys and their chances of, you know, turning the Braves organization around just a year ago to 18 months ago or whatnot. So that just goes to show you, you know, anything can happen in this game, and it's right now things are going very well for the Braves.
Yeah, it's great though that things are going so well. They're still only a half a game ahead of the Mets, who have been swooning recently. Like I think you said before, it doesn't seem like there's enough on this team to push them to a playoff position so far this season. But you can't take away what they've done in the first part of the season. And now with a couple of good breaks, they could stay in the driver's seat in the National League East for a while, which will be really interesting to see. But they're not the only team that's had some exciting guys come up. And I'd like to touch on a couple of other players who have come up from the minor leagues relatively recently and made an impact on their teams. There's three top pitching prospects who have made a splash of sorts over the last couple of weeks. And that's Nick Kingham of the Pirates, Walker Buehler has come up for the Dodgers, and Fernando Romero has very recently come up for the Twins. Three, I would consider top 100, probably, pitching prospects, although Romero's on the border. Buehler is definitely the biggest name of the three. What do you think about these three guys coming up and what they've been able to do for the Pirates and the Dodgers and the Twins in their limited action so far?
Yeah, we talked about Buehler before. I think he's really interesting. You know, the obvious comparison that everyone wants to use for him is to Tim Lincecum, because he's a slight right-hander a little on the smaller side, although I don't believe he's as small as Tim Lincecum. And the question with him is not about stuff, because he's clearly got premium stuff. It's about durability, and it's about consistency with his delivery and whatnot. And I don't know, he's very interesting to me, and I think that I would give him certainly a long leash to figure it out as a starter, but I think he'll probably make it work. And I mean, they're going to have to call upon him, it seems, because they are suffering more rotation injuries. So he's going to get a chance here to, you know, prove his keep and to prove that he belongs in that rotation for the long haul. You know, as far as Kingham, I have been following the Royal Swine for years because I used to write the Pirates annual comments. And it was a bummer to me when he got hurt, because he seemed like a guy who was kind of flying under the radar in that system. You remember they had Tyon, they had Glass now. Those guys obviously received most of the press, even now. I mean, I think Kingham was probably ranked, what, the second or third best arm in that system, maybe the fourth by some list. So he's still successfully flying under the radar. He's got a back-end profile, I think, like a number four profile. You know, he went out there and almost threw a perfect game in his debut. So kudos to him. Although I will say, seeing him do that to the Cardinals and then realizing that both James Shields and Lucas Giolito went out there and had good starts against that same Cardinals lineup within, you know, two or three days, that sort of made me temper my expectations for what Kingham was possible, what was possible for Kingham. But, you know, Fernando Romero, I actually did not get a chance to watch his start, but that Twins team has been such a mess. And, you know, yeah, unfortunately for them, Lance Lynn has been a horrible signing so far. Like a batter per inning. I know that not all of those are intentional, but still, that's grim when we're talking about, you know, five starts, and hopefully he gets going. Maybe the weird offseason really affected him or something. I don't think anyone saw this, even if you're a skeptic of that signing, but he's also seemingly got a chance to, you know, lock himself into a spot there. And, you know, it's always cool to see young arms come up, because I'm a pitching guy and I like watching, you know, these new arms. You never know what you're going to see. I mean, geez, who's that guy for the Angels? He came up like a week ago, and in his first game, they threw him out there in the eighth inning of a, like, I think it was a 1 or 2 run game against the Astros, and he comes out and he throws like 99 miles per hour with a swing and a slider, and it's like, I didn't know who this guy was 30 minutes ago, and now he's out here, you know, look, oh, Justin Anderson, that's who it was.
Yes,
yeah, he's looking
yes.
like he's, it's like, who is this guy? I mean, I had never heard of his name before, and you know, he's out there sitting down the Astros in a high leverage spot. So I like it when the young arms come up, and even if I've heard of them before, it's always cool to see, you know, these guys get their chance. And of those three, I would say, though, I'm still most excited about Buehler. What about you?
Yeah, I'm definitely most excited about Buehler, although it's not hard to get pumped for Kingham's first start. I mean, that was as pretty a debut start as you see in baseball. So I'm really happy to see that. But yeah, Buehler's the talent of the bunch. He's made two starts already this season. He's looked like an ace in both of them, more or less. The Dodgers desperately need some help, as we'll get to in the next segment of the show. But yeah, like you said, it's just always a question mark in the Dodgers' rotation. Who's going to be in? Who's going to be out? Rich Hill may be coming back soon. But you still don't have stability in that rotation, and if they run Buehler out there for the entire season without giving him one of their patented 3-week 10-day DL breaks that for a starting pitcher or something, I don't imagine he'll be ready to go at much of a level in the postseason. That is, if the Dodgers actually, you know, make the postseason. So, yeah, he's really interesting to watch, and I hope he stays healthy, upright, and pitching well for many years to come. But I do have some nervousness about, even if the Dodgers manage his workload, if he'll make it till September at this point.
Yeah, and I mean, geez, the way the Dodgers' depth is dropping, they might not have a choice but to run him out there. Him and Brock Stewart, who I'm not as high on, but
yeah,
that was their entire death plan this season, were those two guys starting in the minors. Now they're both in the majors. I don't really know where they would turn if they have to go to another arm. It might be one of those, you know, veteran journeyman types who, I don't know. That team is in a bad spot right now. And we keep saying, you know, oh, they'll get healthy, they'll make a run. I don't know when they're going to get healthy. It's seemingly going to be one of these things where maybe in June they'll have all their pieces back together, sans Seager, And is that going to be enough? Because the Diamondbacks are not going to go away, it seems. And there's a couple of other teams in that National League West who can make things tough on them just for claiming a wild card spot. So it'll be interesting to see what they do. And I'm going to be honest, I don't buy the – I know we're going to talk about him probably momentarily, but I don't buy the Manny Machado rumors at all for them. So I don't really know where the help is going to come from, and I'm not sure they know where the help is going to come from either.
So we're going to call an audible. We were going to talk a little bit about a couple of other call-ups. One of them is a Dodgers player, but we'll save that for the end of the show, and we'll go straight into the big injuries. Corey Seager, tore his UCL, is going to need Tommy John surgery, is out for the season. He is one of several, really, really important cornerstone players who've received an injury in the first part of the season, actually over the last couple of weeks, and really changes the face of a team's contention plan. And we talked about that with the Dodgers, and I think they are the most interesting and the most important of the teams that we'll talk about in this kind of position. But you look at the Dodgers' injury list right now, Justin Turner hasn't played all season. Corey Seager is now out for the season. Yasiel Puig is on the disabled list. Logan Forsythe is on the disabled list. And all of a sudden, we've got a Dodgers team that's running Max Muncy out there at third base. We've got a Dodgers team that's going to have to rely a lot on guys like Chase Utley and Enrique Hernandez as real regulars for the entire season. Their outfield situation has gotten a little bit messy, but moving Chris Taylor to shortstop and putting Alex Verdugo in at center field it could be a lot worse, let's put it that way, from a defensive standpoint and from an offensive standpoint. But the Dodgers don't seem like the type of team that should be running Breivik Valera out there on their 25-man roster. That just doesn't seem right the way this team is constructed. The Seager injury is a big deal, right? How big of a deal is it?
Well, I think it's a huge deal, and not just because of its individual impact, but all those injuries you mentioned. I mean, you didn't even mention that Ryu left his start last night with a groin injury.
Oh, yeah.
He could be missing time. And, you know, their big offseason additions were Tom Kohler, Scott Alexander, and Matt Kemp. Well, of the three, Kemp is the only one on the active roster. And to his credit, he has been very good offensively. So
yeah.
Kudos to him. But you're right, you know, Max Muncy, Kyle Farmer, Valera. I mean, even if you look at their pitching staff, Shagwell has been huge for them.
Yeah, he has.
You could argue he's been their best reliever, and that's concerning because they got him off waivers right before the season started, and they're having to run Daniel Hudson out there. They've already ran through Wilmer Font. Zach Neal got an appearance. That's like there's a lot of bad things happening with this team, and the cascading effect is, yeah, they're running their B or C left side of the infield out there every day. They're running out some outfielders who they didn't necessarily want to use as much as they're having to use. And yeah, it's a horrible situation for them. And everyone wants to tie them to Manny Machado, but they did so much work to get underneath the luxury tax number. And Andrew Friedman's MO is not to make reactionary deals and not to make big deals in general. I just feel like they're going to end up doing something smaller, like getting Adine Echevarria from the Rays when they finally free Willy Adames. I don't think they're going to swing for the fences, and I don't know that they're going to necessarily make any kind of big deal this year. I think they could well sit out the deadline and just let this one ride out, and if it's a disappointing year, it's a disappointing year. They'll chalk it up to injuries and try again next year. Because, I don't know, I just don't feel like the Machado thing is legitimate, and I don't think that they're going to go out there and make a panic move or anything of the sort.
I agree with you completely in terms of I don't think the Dodgers are going to go out and go get Manny Machado or make some sort of big move even at the deadline, even to get a starting pitcher because of just what you said. If they were going to make a big move, they very well could have done it in the offseason, but they are committed to staying under that luxury tax number, and I don't think that's going to change. If there was a way they could bring in Machado with an equivalent amount of money going out, sure, I would think they would consider it, but that doesn't really seem like much of a possibility either. The concern that I have is that if the Dodgers don't go for it this year, I'm starting to get a little nervous, not a lot nervous, but a little nervous about the team aging out of contention for the amount of money that they've got. Yasmani Grandal is going to be leaving the team next year, and that's not the biggest deal in the world, but he's an important part of this team, and he's been really an important part of this lineup so far this season. And yes, they've got a lot of great young talent in Bellinger and Seager and Verdugo, but there's also a couple of guys who are kind of in the middle of their careers, the primes of their careers, who could be heading towards a downside at some point. You know, Justin Turner, especially with the continued injuries, especially with them being upper body, you have to have some concern about his ability to stay on the field, but also if it'll start taking a toll on his performance. You know, Puig being maybe a non-factor going forward. It's just there's a lot of moving parts with this Dodgers team, and they are a team that needs to reload, if not rebuild at some point. And if they're completely unwilling to do so because of cash reasons or because Andrew Friedman likes to play the long game, they could kind of slide out of the way and get passed by a team like the Diamondbacks, the Rockies, or the Giants.
Yeah, and Kenley Jansen has been uncharacteristically, let's say, bad this year. Yeah. And, you know, they're going to let Clayton Kershaw walk at season's end. I actually don't know if they're going to let Clayton Kershaw walk, but I think there's a better chance than most of us assume. And it wouldn't surprise me at all if Friedman is secretly rooting for the Rangers to blow Kershaw's doors down. Really? And, I mean, in Andrew Friedman's history, do you think he actually wants to give Clayton Kershaw a huge, huge deal and have to deal with those last, say, 2 or 3 years of a 7-year extension or whatnot? Because, I mean, realistically, I feel like Friedman does not want to do that. He would rather have the flexibility that comes from letting him walk, even if it means having to scramble or, you know, put more pressure on a guy like Buehler to step into Kershaw's role come 2019. Now, maybe I'm just imagining that, and maybe Friedman does some creative negotiating that lands him a little bit of insurance on the back end in exchange for having Kershaw for the next 2 or 3 or 4 seasons. But I don't know, man. I think there's a better chance than we're giving it credit for.
Well, let me put it this way. I think that if he does let Kershaw walk, that's a fireable offense. I understand you don't want to spend $40 million a year on a starting pitcher who's got some back issues, but this is the guy you do it for, and you're the Dodgers. You're not the Rays anymore. You gotta spend the money when you got it. So I don't put it past you exactly what you're saying, and few people know the history of Andrew Friedman as well as you do, but God, that would be so stupid. I would get so angry at Friedman if I were a Dodgers fan and that were the case.
I mean, let's sum it up this way with Andrew Friedman. Obviously, he's one of the best in the game and has been since he got a general manager's position, but we're so used to him chasing value and chasing surplus and all that good stuff that it's actually a little bit surprising that Kenta Maeda is remaining in the rotation, even though the Dodgers' rotation is decimated, because by moving him to the bullpen, they would have to pay him significantly less. So we're actually a little bit surprised that, oh, the Dodgers aren't going to try to maximize their efficiency and, you know, lower their payroll further by doing something that would make no sense baseball-wise. But again, that's Andrew Friedman. He is someone who takes his efficiency very seriously, and he's probably going to hate himself for signing Clayton Kershaw to whatever deal he signs him to, because it goes against his MO.
Yeah, and he'll probably do what you're mentioning with Maeda next year. So
yes. Or like July, once they get healthy and make a small trade for Francisco Liriano or whatever.
Oh God, that is dark. That is a horrible prediction for the future that I would not be surprised if it came true. The Dodgers aren't the only team that's dealing with a major injury right now, because it's, well, the baseball season and we get major injuries all the time. Another team that was projected to play well this year, if not as well as the Dodgers, was the New York Mets. And they got off to a really hot start, but their best player is Jacob deGrom, and their best player has been pulled with a hyperextended right elbow, which always makes you worry. Elbow injury to a pitcher on their pitching elbow. Not only that, but DeGrom has had a series of elbow issues over the last several years, what with ulnar nerve transplant, or realignment, I should say. I think this is somewhat close to as big of a deal as the Seager injury for the Mets playoff chances, because DeGrom has secretly been, you know, one of the top 5 pitchers in baseball over the last several years, and this is a devastating move for a team like the Mets, who's got a lot of questions in their starting rotation. DeGrom's been the anchor for it for a long time, and they kind of needed both him and Syndergaard to stay healthy to stay in contention, I think. We don't know exactly what the surgery, or if there's going to be surgery, or what this injury is going to look like in the future, but how do you see this DeGrom injury? Do the Mets have enough starting pitching to survive it and claw their way into a wild card spot, or is this the type of move that's going to derail a season?
I mean, you're not excited about Matt Harvey potentially moving back to the rotation for a few weeks?
I think Matt Harvey will move back into the rotation right after hell freezes over.
You don't think he's going to be... Who do you think they're going to call up in his place if DeGrom misses, say, 4 weeks?
I don't know, honestly, at this point. I mean, they were kind of in that position where they demoted Harvey because Vargas came back, and now Vargas looks like crap, too. I mean, at this point, they may want to move Gesellman back in or Seth Lugo for a... Seth Lugo's been pitching longer stints in the bullpen. I would like to see them pop him in there in DeGrom's spot, but... I mean, all the options are bad. Maybe it's Corey Oswalt, honestly, from the minors. He might be the guy they want to bring in to do that.
And Lugo's pitching with elbow injury of his own, isn't he? I believe he has like a...
Well, he's a Mets pitcher, so yeah, he's pitching with an injury.
That's fair, but no, this is very impactful to them. Like you mentioned, this has sort of become a top-heavy rotation where, you know, DeGrom and Syndergaard kind of have to make up for some of the sins of rest of the starters. And yeah, if Vargas isn't going to be, you know, around a league average arm, all of a sudden you're talking about having potentially three black spots in the rotation, with three black holes, I mean, with Harvey, Vargas, and Matt, who just cannot seem to put it together. And yeah, I mean, it's not good when Zach Wheeler is like the second or third best arm in your rotation. Actually, it'd be the second best, because Syndergaard would be the best. And yeah, it's brutal. And you know, even if you talk about moving Lugo or Gesellman or whomever into the rotation, that affects your bullpen, and there's a lot of cascading effects there that can harm this team. So, you know, if you're looking at a list of guys who the Mets could not afford to lose, DeGrom was one or number two, you know, behind Syndergaard. And it's unfortunate, because it feels like, oh, it's the same old Mets, right? Like, you know, DeGrom getting hurt on a swing is just Messy into the core. So that's kind of, it's amusing in the sense that, you know, that's what always happens with the Mets. You know, they're kind of like a Greek comedy in that sense, but it's also disappointing because you're right, he is one of the top pitchers in baseball. He's a blast to watch, and it was fun seeing the Mets come out of the gate strong, and it was fun seeing Mets fans, you know, start to get behind this team. And it was fun, you know, seeing Mickey Callaway get New York Times Magazine treatment as basically like this managing prodigy because of his first month on the job. And now it's like, oh, now he gets to experience what it's like being the Mets manager. The first 4 weeks were just a fever dream, or whatever you want to say. So yeah, it's potentially very harmful for the Mets depending on how long he misses.
Yeah, I mean I see this as one of those things where even if he comes back quickly from this injury, you're going to be cringing every time he throws a nasty slider or something all season long. And that's not going to be much fun either. And you're going to kind of wait for the other shoe to drop for him to tear his ACL, or, you know, injuries tend to have a cascading effect. So if his elbow is relatively weak, there may be some extra stress on his UCL, and we could see Tommy John surgery later in the future. And the Mets are horrible at managing these injuries. If he needs a month off to recover for his elbow, I wouldn't put it past the Mets to give him 2 weeks, right, or not even put him on the, you know, 10-day DL as they want to do. So that worries me, because they have no history of managing these injuries well, even though they have a newer staff this year for injury management. We still seem to see kind of the same old, same old. So I don't like this. It's bad. And that's about all there is to say about it. At the same time, thanks to the Nationals playing like garbage to start the season, I don't think the Mets are out of it yet.
No, of course not. But, you know, I don't think any team, or excuse me, I don't think the Mets are out of it by any means. And I don't think that you can necessarily count on the Nationals to, you know, blow the doors down either, because they're dealing with a ton of injury issues of their own. Mm-hmm. And again, it's sort of like a Dodgers situation where we keep saying, oh, they'll get going, but you know, it seems like every week they lose someone new, or every few days they lose someone new, and you're saying, okay, well, when is it going to be, eventually they'll get going? Is it going to be in June? Is it going to be in July? Or are we talking about, you know, a 2-month run? Because you try to, you know, you start putting it into those terms, and it's like, well, I don't know, man. I don't know. And I don't think the Mets are done by any means, but I do feel a little bit more uncomfortable in having them as my dark horse in the National League. Of course, my dark horse in the American League was the Oakland A's, and they got struck out 16 times last night, but still found a way to win. And that's what winners do, Brian. They take their lumps, and then they still find a way to win in the end. So,
That is painfully true. So there is one more injury I want to talk about, and I want to – well, there's a lot of injuries I want to talk about, but in this segment – there's one more important injury that I want to get to. And I want to take you back to an anecdote real quick. Earlier in the season, right at the beginning of the season, I went on SiriusXM's Fantasy Drive, and the hosts, Kyle and Ray, asked me about Johnny Cueto. And they said, you know, Johnny Cueto didn't pitch very well last year. What are your thoughts on him coming into the season? And I said, you know, I really like Johnny Cueto. I think he's going to bounce back well this year. I think he's going to, you know, continue to be the consistent starter that he was before 2017. He may not be at his, you know, Reds kind of peak that we saw for a little while, but we can kind of expect him to make at least 30 starts, and I think he's going to go back to being the really solid number two type of starter that we had seen in the past from him. So we get 4 or 5 games into the season, and I feel wonderful. Johnny Cueto pitched beautifully to start the season. So I was right, but I wasn't right about the stability. And so now Cueto has an elbow injury. He's about to go out and get a second and third opinion on this injury, one of which is going to come from Dr. James Andrews, which means his elbow is probably shot for the season. It's not a sure thing yet, but it's tough to imagine that Cueto will be able to continue this run of excellent pitching that he's had to start this season. And the Giants may be without their, I don't know, he had been their best starter this season, but probably their second or third starter. I don't know. Does this take the Giants kind of out of contention in a very competitive National League West?
Well, it's the cascading effect again, because as you mentioned, you know, Madison Bumgarner, he's still out. Andrew McCutchen left yesterday's game after getting hit in the elbow. Who knows if he's going to miss any time. Mark Melanson's out. Joe Panik's out. Hunter Pence's out, which might be actually a good thing. But Matt Williamson is also out. Even Josh Osich is out. So they're dealing with a ton of injuries. It seems like you have to be dealing with a ton of injuries if you're a team of a National League West. I've been a little bit more down on this team as the season progressed. I'm just not really a Ty Block guy. And I'm not really a Chris Stratton guy. And then when you combine those two as like the good part of your rotation with Gerrit Holland, current Jeff Samardzija, and Andrew Suarez, who's a decent prospect, but let's be clear, he would not be as highly regarded, in most other systems. I mean, this is sort of a product of being in a bad system that he's considered like their second best arm.
Yeah, if you're the number 6 prospect in the Giants system, that's a lot like being the number 15 prospect in other systems.
Right. So, and you know, maybe this is irrational of me, but it's hard for me to watch Sam Dyson or Hunter Strickland pitch in a close game and assume that they won't blow it.
Right.
I don't know. There's something about those guys that I just, they scare me. And I say that as probably the biggest Reyes-Moranta fan in existence, which is probably not something I should be saying publicly, but I do like him, and I think he might actually end up surpassing those two at some point. But yeah, I don't know. I look at this team, and I definitely appreciate what they did this winter and trying to go for it, but I am not sure there's enough there. Obviously, I don't think there's enough there to win the National League West, but I'm starting to be, you know, to believe that they're just not going to be able to make a serious run at the wild card either because of the health and because of some of the performances they've been getting elsewhere on this roster. I mean, Austin Jackson's been miserable.
Yeah.
And I know McCutchen and Longoria both have OPS pluses over 100 now, but like, think about who they're going to be running out there at some of these positions. You know, it's like Kelby Tomlinson. It's going to be, what, Porky Hernandez again. Alan Hansen is in the majors. It's not a good sign when you have Alan Hansen, Kelby Tomlinson, and Pablo Sandoval on your bench and you're trying to be a competitive team in 2018.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. Although Sandoval has proven that he could slide into that bullpen and not look too much different from most of the other guys who are in that San Francisco bullpen.
I never thought we would see Pablo Sandoval pitching, and I would never thought that we would see Pablo Sandoval pitching and people coming away impressed by his breaking ball. So
I know.
This truly is the weirdest timeline.
Well, that is super, super weird. I think the Giants are probably done. I wasn't really high on them coming into the season, although I was very excited for the Evan Longoria and Andrew McCutchen experience. But, you know, I do think Longoria has been playing very well, considering the fact he hasn't reached base ever. This offseason, he's completely stopped walking, which is a very, very weird thing to see. But at least he's hitting the ball when he hits. Yeah, it's just a weird season for a weird team, and I really still like their lineup. But you mentioned that Joe Panik's out now, too, and I'm just not sure that this team has the depth to keep going and compete with a team like the Diamondbacks or even the Rockies at this point. So it'll be interesting to see how it turns out, but this is not exactly what I would have expected to start the season, despite the fact that the Giants are a little bit of an older team.
Yeah. I mean, Joe Panik is one of their younger regulars, right? He might be their youngest regular. I can't think of anyone who was necessarily younger off the top of my head. And by the way, Joe Panik's a pretty solid player. I mean, I know when he was involved in the Giancarlo Stanton rumors, we all had fun at his expense. But, you know, that guy has turned into I think, above-average player overall. If not, he's around league average, which is, you know, perfectly fine. I know his defense doesn't always get good ratings from the advanced metrics, but he's a solid little player, and so missing him is actually a bigger deal than you probably think it would be, in part because of who they had to replace him, and also in part because he is a nifty hitter, and yeah, I guess I'm a little disappointed that he's down, because he's one of my favorite kind of under-the-radar guys. I know we both have an appreciation for DJ LeMahieu.
Yes.
And Panik is not as good of a defender as LeMahieu, and certainly does not have the same offensive track record, but that's kind of the mold it reminds me of as a guy who maybe goes underneath the radar a little bit at second base because he doesn't put up, you know, Altuve-like or, you know, since we just talked about him, Ozzie Albies-type numbers. But he is, you know, a solid little player, and it's disappointing to see him go down. Hunter Pence, meanwhile, I think he's cooked. So, him missing doesn't necessarily change their outlook. But guys like Panik and Bumgarner and Cueto, yeah, they're in trouble.
Yeah, for sure. So let's transition to shortening this up a little bit, do some quick hits on a couple of other moves, a couple of other call-ups, injuries, and one or two guys who have moved teams. We'll start things off with, we'll quickly go back to a call-up. The one that I don't think we've talked about that was kind of interesting to me was Lourdes Gurriel getting called up by the Blue Jays to play third base for a little while. He didn't exactly cover himself with glory in that limited run with the Jays, and he may be on his way out as Josh Donaldson's about ready to come back from his injury. But what are your thoughts on Gurriel?
I was surprised they brought him up. That was not one I expected at all, especially after this winter they went out there and got Solarte and Diaz to kind of fortify their depth. But obviously, you know, Jordan Kulawiecki's been hurt. They just optioned Devon Travis. So
that's a surprise.
That is a surprise. Travis's star has really fallen off, hasn't it?
Yeah, I think the lost development time because he hasn't been able to play regularly, he always seems to be injured, has really hurt him. I think it's great that the Jays have enough depth in acquiring Solarte and Aledmys Diaz, who, don't get me wrong, I'm still not the world's biggest Aledmys Diaz fan, but they have enough depth that they can deal with these injuries. But I think we're just killing time until the Guerrero and Bichette call-ups happen at this point. Because Diaz isn't good. Gurriel did not play well in his limited time in the team. And the Jays are probably still not in a position where they're going to be really competitive this year, even though they're off to a hot start this season. So I'm still nervous about this team in the long term and the short term. But it would have been nice to see Gurriel play really, really well in his time for the call up. But I think he's going to head back down for some more seasoning.
Yeah, and I don't think that he has the potential that his name value brings. I mean, He wasn't even ranked in BP species in the top 10 for the Jays, and you know, maybe credit that to the death of the system. But at the same time, you know, this is what they ended the write-up with. There is appeal as a potential platoon or solid hitting bench bat with some defensive versatility. So, best case is like a poor man's Indurba Solarte.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah, I mean, again, that's fine, but it's not really what you expected when he signed with all that hype. So, that's a bummer.
Well, chunk together a few moves that I think are somewhat related. So we've had a lot of injuries over the last couple of weeks. I'd like to hit a couple of the hitter injuries. Will Myers went to the disabled list from the Padres. We already mentioned Yasiel Puig went to the DL from the Dodgers. Eric Thames is going to be out for a little while for the Brewers, and Miguel Sano is out for the Twins. So we've got Sano, Puig, Myers, and Thames. Most of these guys are playing for teams that are disappointing in one way or another. Maybe we can make an exception there for the Brewers and Eric Thames, but I don't know. Which of these injuries do you think is the biggest deal for these teams? Is it Sano, who really is a main driver of the Twins lineup? Is it Thames, who is a big part of the team that's running away with the National League Central? Is it Will Myers, who is so essential to a team like the Padres, who is relatively offensively limited? Or, you know, we've already talked a little bit about Puig, and he's just another in a series of unfortunate events for the Dodgers.
Well, it's probably Thames of those guys, right? Because at least the Brewers are competitive and whatnot. And, you know, you talk about the Padres being offensively limited. It's kind of funny. Where would they be without one of the biggest additions seemingly in franchise history? I'm talking about Christian Villanueva, because he has really made the most of his opportunity. 9 home runs. Did you expect Christian Villanueva to have 9 home runs all season?
I didn't expect Christian Villanueva to have 9 hits all season. This is incredible.
Right. I mean, he's hitting .299, .384, .667, and you're like, wow. Because you compare that to Eric Hosmer, and Hosmer has been great. .303, .402, .505, and it's man, I am so glad they have Christian Villanueva in this lineup.
Yeah, he's pushed, Villanueva has really, you know, pushed Headley to the bench, which is, you don't really expect to think like that, even though Headley has been quite a different player recently. But
okay, yeah, let's just talk about that Chase Headley deal real quick. I know we have better things to talk about, but they basically took Headley's contract seemingly to get Brian Mitchell in return, right?
Right.
And Brian Mitchell has been, I think he's the worst starting pitcher in baseball. Let me just read you this stat line. Like, 29 and two-thirds innings. He's allowed 33 hits, 20 runs. He's walked 23, only one of those being intentional. He has 14 strikeouts. That's, just to read the rates, 10 hits, 1.2 home runs, 7 walks, and 4.2 strikeouts per 9. He does not miss bats. He is in his age 27 season. There's literally no reason to think he has any future whatsoever as a starting pitcher, perhaps even as a relief pitcher at this point. And yet he keeps getting starts. And Edwin Jackson has to look at that and be like, really?
Yeah.
Really? You could have given me that job instead? And yeah, that's, whew. Man, that's bad. Anyway, I think we have actual major leaguers to talk about.
Well, that's true. And I just want to briefly talk about Thames for a second, because it could be a lot worse for the Brewers. I mean, the Brewers can slide Ryan Braun in now as the everyday first baseman. They have Jesus Aguilar, which both those guys are right-handed hitters, and it would be nice to have the lefty Thames in the lineup. I mean, this team can survive this. The Brewers are ready to roll, man. And they brought up
Brewers
Brett Phillips.
First place.
Yeah, the Brewers have brought up Brett Phillips, who's a decent left-handed hitter, now who can support them. So I think things are going to be okay in Milwaukee.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, of course. Yeah, they have depth. That's one of the things this team maybe got underrated for, because, you know, everybody talked about their outfield depth and like, oh, what are they going to do with Domingo Santana? And I know he's been bad this year, but having Domingo Santana as a reserve outfielder speaks to your depth, right? And having, you know, the ability to shuffle those guys around with Braun at first base, you know, that allowed them to do some things that a lot of teams are not able to do. Now, granted, you know, if they suffered an injury on the middle infield, you know, then you can't move Braun around to kind of make up for that. But it's certainly a nice, you know, trump card to have. And, you know, we can talk about Wade Miley at this point, right?
Yes, we can.
I'm really rooting for Wade Miley to be good just to kind of blow all of our minds. I'm not expecting it, but I'm hoping that he goes out there and looks like vintage Wade Miley. And I mean that in a good way, not a bad way, because that would be a fun little development. And they really need another starting pitcher. And I still don't know how they missed on Lynn and Odorizzi and
Well, it's probably a good thing they missed on Lynn, but
yes. And Cobb even. So
yeah, that's
maybe
wild.
They knew what they were doing after all, and we were all stupid for assuming those veteran starting pitchers who have strong track records would remain productive heading forward, at least in the short term. So
and you mentioned vintage Wade Miley. He made his start yesterday, last night for the Brewers. He gave up one run on three hits with three walks and four strikeouts and six innings to get a win. That's vintage Wade Miley for you.
That's basically his career numbers right there. Yes. So,
six strikeouts per nine, a few too many walks, but keeping the ball in the park, and that's exactly what you pay for when you sign Wade Miley. So good on them.
He's a league average starter. That's a huge boost to them, to be clear, though. So we make fun of his career, but he's just league average. That's a win.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not diminishing that. By the way, while we're on the subject of Wade Miley, another left-handed pitcher of dubious distinction over the last couple of years was brought up. The Athletics looks like are going to be slotting former Athletic great Brett Anderson into their rotation. I saw Brett Anderson pitch last year, and I think he can hold up in the A's rotation. I'm interested to see how this goes.
I saw Brett Anderson pitch last year as well. I believe it was opposite Chris Tillman. And boy, let me tell you, I was thrilled with that pitching matchup. That was just
totally.
Yeah,
classic.
I don't. If the A's are actually depending on Brett Anderson for any length of time, I think that's a bad sign for my AL dark horse, because I'm just not a believer in his health. And I mean, over under, does he make five starts, or do you think he's
I've got the on that. I think that he'll end up making over the course of the season. I think he's going to be the sixth starter for this team. So I think there will be a couple of instances where he pops up and has to do some work. And he pitched, I'll say, well enough in his first start of the season where he was able to, he held Seattle to two runs over six and a third. So that'll get you another start. So that's two. And it'll take, I understand that Jarrell Cotton's injured. He's got his Tommy John surgery. But this is not a team that's got a copious amount of depth. I just am shocked that in the year 2018, Trevor Cahill and Brett Anderson are in the A's rotation. This is just blowing my mind.
Imagine being a baseball fan who, I don't want to say a coma, but imagine you just like stop following baseball for a few years. And the last time you followed baseball, Anderson and Cahill were in the rotation. And imagine coming back this year and being like, wow, the A's really held on to their young talent. That's unusual for them.
They must have been phenomenal over the last 10 years, and we got to keep them around when really, secretly, everything is bad.
Except for Shawn Manaea. He is very good. And, I can't talk up our boy Andrew Triggs, so we should move on.
Yeah, let's do that. So a couple of other injuries. Jordan Montgomery is going to be knocked out of the Yankees rotation for a while. The Yankees signed David Hale to replace him. Boy, that's not the same sort of trade-off you want to make if you're the Yankees and trying to chase down the Red Sox, right?
Yeah, and I really like Jordan Montgomery. He kind of gets overshadowed with all the other young talent there, but he has a chance to have a lengthy big league career as a middle-to-back-end starter, a lefty with a plethora of decent pitches. He's going to be out, I think, 6 to 8 weeks. That's a bummer. But they do have young talent they can bring up to replace Montgomery, especially if they tire of, are they really going to start Hale?
I don't know if they're going to start him, but they added him to the roster as kind of the replacement. I think he'll work in long relief.
Yeah, I think they – I don't know if they've announced it, but my guess is they're going to go with Domingo German instead. Excuse me, Herman. Domingo Herman. And I would assume he'll get the call, but – yeah, because I think starting David Hale, come on.
Yeah,
service time manipulation.
I would think they'd have to use Herman or A.J. Cole in that position.
Gosh.
I really said that. But I really want to see them go with Chance Adams. I think it's going to be his time very soon.
Yeah, I mean that should be the play, Adams or Justice Sheffield. I know he's only in Double A, so it probably will be Adams. But you know, one of those younger guys. And again, this is one of the reasons why I was so high on the Yankees. They have all this depth from within, not only on their big league roster. I mean, you know, to be able to just kind of use Neil Walker as like a super sub or whatever. That's an impressive amount of depth. And yeah, the Yankees are good, and I think they're the best positioned franchise in baseball over the next 5 years, based on everything we know today about their roster, their prospects, you know, wealth, and their financial flexibility heading into this winter. I think they're the most likely team to win a World Series in the next 5 years.
That's impressive. That's something to say. Another team that's losing an important starting pitcher is the Diamondbacks, with Robbie Ray hitting the disabled list. We're not 100% sure who's going to be replacing him in the rotation, but it doesn't seem like this is it right now. It doesn't seem like this is an injury that's going to keep him out for the whole season. It looks like something that might be a shorter term one. But it's possible that Chris Medlin will return to the major leagues as a starting pitcher in Robbie Ray's place for the Diamondbacks. I don't see this as a big deal for the Diamondbacks right now, because the Diamondbacks are playing so well and they've got some depth. And even with Taijuan Walker's injury, I feel like they still can withstand this to some extent. But there's going to be a point where enough is enough and they're really going to be hurting from this. And I love Robbie Ray. I love watching Robbie Ray pitch. But I'm actually kind of excited about seeing Medlin back in the major leagues.
Yeah, he used to be one of my favorites. Athletic little guy who knew how to pitch, had a good changeup. Obviously, injuries befell him, and now he's, you know, at the situation where he couldn't even crack this pitching staff to open camp. But hopefully, he does well. And I think maybe, you know, maybe Robbie Ray needed a little bit of a mental reset, because he's been kind of rough this year. And it's one of those situations where he's a two-pitch guy without great command, and those guys can kind of run through some tough stretches when they're unable to get ahead in the count. You know, kind of eliminates the slider as a weapon, and yeah, leaves him out to dry. I will note they already have your old friend Matt Cook in the rotation as well.
He
He was
is
part
not
of the.
my old friend. He used to play for the Mets, but he is
He's
not an
just
old
old friend.
friend.
But he has, old friend or not, he has been a pleasant surprise to the rotation so far, at least. And
I mean,
yeah,
yeah,
19 innings, but yeah.
he's been he has not embarrassed himself, which is phenomenal. I never would have expected that he would make the major leagues for an extended period at this point in his career. So good on him. I'm excited to see him get a World Series ring if the Diamondbacks win out
You
this
are
year.
so mean to your old friend.
I mean,
Ah.
that's just it. Like, the reason I say that is not because I dislike Matt Cook, but because, like, even as a hardcore Mets fan, I didn't care about Matt Cook, because you never thought he was really going to be the guy. And the fact that he would eventually get a role and be starting for a good team is great. I think it's really, you know, a testament to guys who hang around and keep doing the work, and hopefully they can get there. But
Speaking of that, Fernando Salas is a 1.56 ERA.
isn't that awesome? I think that's just
Yes.
fantastic. I'm
It's not
so
gonna
happy
last,
for
so
the
it's
guy.
cool.
Yeah, it's not gonna last, but as I will ride that train for a long time. That is a wonderful thing. Other smaller injuries. Daniel Norris is going to have groin surgery. He's going to be out for a little while, but the Tigers are pretty much irrelevant, despite their position as number two, I think, in the American League Central right now. Surprisingly good for the Tigers, but unsurprisingly, probably not going to factor into much this season. We already mentioned briefly Kenyon Middleton of the Angels is going to be out with an injury for a little while, but the Angels have six or seven other closers that they can fit in of varying degrees of capability. And then also JP Crawford of the Phillies is going to hit the DL. Nick Kingery, excuse me, Scott Kingery, Nick Kingham, Scott Kingery. Scott Kingery will get most of the starts in shortstop instead of him. And then Tim Beckham of the Orioles. Adding insult to injury for this Orioles season, he'll be out for a little while as well. So I think that covers most of the big injuries. Did I miss anything?
I mean, I'm sure we missed injuries, but no, I think that's basically all we had to talk about on that regard. And then we had a few other minor moves from famous names. Jose Bautista was signed by the Braves to play third base in AAA until presumably they bring him to the majors for a quick look-see. And then Clay Buchholz, who I think most everyone kind of assumed was retired or, working on his novel or screenplay or whatever it is that Clay Buchholz would like to work on, was released by the Royals despite not appearing in the majors this season. And that's a bummer. That's a pair of bummers because, Jose Bautista had a great second half of his career and he's kind of reduced to, novelty act, I suppose. I don't think there's a lot left there. And if he's a league average bat, that's a huge win for them. But I don't know. I'm skeptical that he's even that anymore. And that's a shame because he, again, had a very great run with the Toronto Blue Jays.
Yeah, I'm not counting him out yet. I think that there could be something here. I don't expect him to return to Jose Bautista dumb. I don't see him hitting 50 home runs. I don't see him being much more than a, replacement level to slightly above replacement level player. But he is almost exactly the type of, he's a great fit for the Braves, actually, I feel like. Between being a respected veteran who will provide some fire to the team, a team that's kind of stocked with younger players, I feel like he's probably an improvement over Preston Tucker as a last bat on the bench and a guy who can provide some power in a pinch. And the fact that they're using him a lot at third base in the minor leagues makes me happy that the Braves aren't thinking Ryan Flaherty is going to continue to hit like this forever. So that kind
that's
of
what makes you happy.
Yeah, it does. It honestly does, because I don't like it when teams have unrealistic expectations for their role players just because they get off to a hot start. So honestly, I think that this is something where we're going to see some Jose Bautista in the major leagues with this Braves team. The Braves also, though, they do love to hire big name guys to go play in Gwinnett. They can be a backup, but they did this with Ryan Howard last year, where they brought Ryan Howard in and he sold tickets for the AAA team, which is owned by the Braves. So it's not something that's totally surprising to me. And I wouldn't be surprised if they kind of wrote it off and they just let him play there for a little bit to help sell tickets and get people excited for the Gwinnett Stripers. But, I think he'll actually show up in the major leagues, and I think he can still hit a little bit. It's been disappointing to see his power kind of tail off, and if he can tap into it just a little bit, I think he'll be useful to the team.
Yeah, and why I feel like you were kind of side-eyeing Tim Tebow as you said that about selling minor league tickets, because I definitely felt your attention float elsewhere, and
yeah,
it felt like it was directed at Tebow.
Truthfully, it's more just about how much I hate the way the Braves run their minor league affiliates. But I'm always side-eyeing Tim Tebow just a little bit.
Aren't we all? But I think that's basically all we had to cover. So that was a couple weeks of baseball moves and injuries, and mostly injuries. I feel like that's all we get to talk about anymore, are injuries. The show went from, exciting and spring, look at all these beautiful rosters and transactions, and now it's just injury after injury, reminding us that we're all mortal, and we're all just a breath away from injuring our oblique.
That's so true, especially with you and I on our running plans. We are always a breath away of injuring our obliques. I think that part of it has to do, though, with this is kind of the down part of the season for transactions. We out instead of getting to get breathless over about new names and new places and things like that, we actually have to watch the baseball and watch guys actually play and do fun, interesting things on the field rather than watching the front offices do fun, interesting things off the field. So I got to be honest with you. I don't mind it. I think it's fun to watch some baseball.
But yeah, because you have to write up the transactions. So this is the best time of the year for you. It's too early for trades and not late enough for, I don't know. What was I going to say? Not late enough. Oh, I guess free agent signings and whatnot. Oh, if you're the Texas Rangers, it might be about time for trades. Could you see Robin Cicerino slotting in? I know we've talked about him with the Mets before, but you didn't necessarily buy that fit. But could you see Robin Cicerino getting moved in the next month to a team who?
Absolutely, especially if some team has an important catcher injury. Yeah, absolutely. The Rangers, there are a few teams where we're already they've got to probably sell at some point. And I think the Rangers are one of them. The Orioles, quite obviously, are one of them. The White Sox and the Royals don't have anything to sell, kind of the same as the Reds. So I think those teams will probably stand pat. But if they got anything they can deal off, it's probably time to do it.
Yep. And if we have anything we need to deal off, like a producer Sean Brody, who's never here with us anymore, we're opening talks on that front. So
Yeah, make
that's
us an
about all,
offer.
though.
Make us an
That's about
offer.
all we have going on. So this is a fun episode.
Yeah, I had a good time. I'm glad we could do this. And if you are interested in more DFA podcasts, you can find us on Twitter at DFA Podcast. You can email us at dfa@baseballprospectus.com. You can find RJ's work over at CBS Sports, where we have where it's an absolutely wonderful piece on Carlos Pena and the 2003 Detroit Tigers. You want to talk briefly about that and what you were able to do with that article on CBS Sports?
What a clean segue, because I heard something drop and you walking away to pick up whatever it was and throw it to me. That's why he's a veteran in this, folks. But yes, I talked to Carlos Peña, among others, about the 2003 Tigers and how they can teach us a lot about the modern baseball landscape. A lot of teams out there are not trying to be competitive, and what team would know more about that than the team that lost literally the second most games in post-integration history? And of course, the team that lost the most was the Mets, but they were an expansion team. The Tigers just played like one. And the one fun statistic that I've been throwing out there is imagine our reaction, literally Ryan and I's reaction, if a 55-win team either traded or non-tendered four of their top five statistical contributors and did little to replace them, because that is exactly what the 2002 Tigers did. And that gave birth to, again, one of the worst teams of all time. But it's an inspiring tale, believe it or not, because of thoughtful, elegant folks like Carlos Peña and Matt Wolbeck, who kind of put things into perspective. And there's also some stuff on the 2004 draft and how Justin Verlander was very nearly not signed by the Tigers. And additionally, who they would have taken had the Padres not been cheap and drafted Verlander for themselves. So a lot of potentially fun stuff in there if you are interested in the 2003 Tigers 15 years later.
Which you should be. You should be interested in the 2003 Tigers. I think we can learn a lot. So, on that note, we will call it a show. Thank you so much for listening, and we will catch you next time.